International African Revolution.
They say Bob Marley's the king of reggae, and they say Sparrow is the king of calypso. They say Calypso Rose is the queen of calypso. But listen, people, this one is talking tempo. Get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All I must get it straight, for we is great. You can't tell I that I's of a third world country when I don't know I's African. Not only that I's of a first world country, but it was my foreparents them who brought forth civilization. One of the greatest things from the Almighty I know was the River Nile. Eh, it was the same riverbank where Miriam did left baby Moses as a child. You didn't know, huh? And Ramesses, Nefertiti, Tutankhamun, and them, oh ho, is I history does want to tilt and chat beer filled when you don't know how them mind shocking pyramids was built. Just get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. Don't tell I a thing about royalty, cause I don't know his majesty. Don't tell I a thing about Elizabeth or Victoria, cause they would have to repeat the works of Ningxia, Cleopatra, and Queen of Sheba, of which I know they can't. So people, help me with the chant. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. Cause Jah loveth the gates of Zion more than all the dwelling places of Jacob. And glorious things have been spoken unto thee, O city of God, Selah. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. And the riches that they did rob we is still sitting over there in Vatican City. So I know the walls of Rome will have to shake, either a volcanic eruption or a mystical earthquake. Get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. All you must get it straight, for we is great. And with constant day-to-day tribulation, South Africans are dying for redemption, which only requires the unification of each and everyone. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. You must get it straight, for we is great. You better get it straight, Africans, get it straight. I want you to get it straight, for we is great. Now just go along.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And we came out of the box tonight with the music of Sister Carol, a song called Get It Straight African, Get It Straight. And we have an action-packed show for you today. And we are going to be speaking with Amdi, one of the Watts prophets, coming from Los Angeles, California. We're also going to be speaking with Audrey Redman, a First Nations sister from she's living in Ontario now, but she's originally from Saskatchewan. And we're going to do a second part of our tribute to Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I would like to thank two people, like I thank every week, for my spot on Uhuru Radio. First, I would like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishitella for providing me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I also would like to thank Archie Shepp, who gave me the concept of diasporic music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we have some exciting shows on Uhuru Radio, and we wanted you to stay tuned to Straight from the Streets. We have O'Malley Ishitella Speaks. We have Africa Live. We have Reparations in Action. We have a Revolutionary Health and Fitness. We have Ron Bob Simple is so nice. He's on more than he's on more than twice. Ron Bob Simple is on Golden Sunday Sounds. He's on Caribbean Forum, and he's on a Great Moments in African History. And we have a Black Radio Agenda with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. And we have a report from Africans in Sweden and throughout Europe. And we are going to, this is Black Music Month. June is Black Music Month. And President Barack Hussein Obama has changed Black Music Month to African-American Music Appreciation Month. I guess he wants us to appreciate when I used to go to junior high school and high school music appreciation, they taught us to we should appreciate Bach and Beethoven and Rachmaninoff and people like that. And frankly, I have no problem listening or appreciating their music, but I just like to, I appreciate Howlin' Wolf probably more than European classical music, but that's just me. And we're going to go to Africa right now with a young man who was born in Barbados, and he was the first rap artist, I think, to go to Africa. His name is Dougie Fresh, and the song is called Africa, Going Back Home.
Wow, man bamay waja delo gale sama nit ñi fi don nañ nema buñu fi indale garabu garabu waye deglu malen ngir xamna ni liñ len sacc seen dara rek lañu mëna xam xam sa aada nak moy sa yoon bu leer nak bo bëgge bari xam xam da ngay nango gëstu man dagi fresh. Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I left to go to Africa, people said, don't come back with no witchcraft on your head. I just left the comment blank and kept my cool because they only said what they was taught in school. Brainwash education of our nation, publicizing its prime to be behind time. Adequate excuse and all verbal abuse. Our history's a mystery, or what's the use? You know what I'm saying? So we're gonna kick it off like this. Now I took me a trip to Africa, a 7-hour flight from America. I got off the plane and what did I see? But some brothers and sisters who look like me. Warm greeting, hello highs, a lot of mosquitoes and a whole lot of flies. Young ones tried to persuade you to buy, to feed the family so no one died of hunger, shelter, clothes, and starvation. And in the ghetto it's the same situation. Over big water so far I roam, to find my way back home. To find my way back home. To find my way back home. Now bust it. Now I woke up at 2 in the afternoon, in the middle of December, which felt like June. I got on a bus, then all of us caught a boat as we listened to the jams we wrote. As the boat stayed afloat and we was close to shore, I seen an island, one I thought I seen before. I was gonna ask the guy, but I forgot his name, so I said it ain't nothing. All islands are the same. Shame, who's to blame for that inside shame? Then I found out Gory Island was the name. Aim was to proceed with the mystery of the hidden, forbidden history. Gory Island was the last place the slaves was bought before taken to America, sold and bought. I could feel it in the air when my feet touched land, to be the first rap group to rock African. Our distant brothers, great great grandmothers, to one another is you I salute, because a man without history is like a tree without roots. So I say now, I took me a trip to Africa, a 7-hour flight from America. I got off the plane and what did I see? But some brothers and sisters who look like me. Warm greeting, hello highs, a lot of mosquitoes and a whole lot of flies. Young ones try to persuade you to buy, to feed the family so no one dies of hunger, shelter, clothes, or starvation. And in the ghetto it's the same situation. Over big water so far I roam, to find my way back home.
to find my way back home. To find my way back, to find my way back. To find my way back home, it's like that.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we have been listening to the music of Roy Ayers and Fela. They gave us a song called Africa, Son of a Girl, and Roy Ayers is going to celebrate his birthday on September the 10th. He was born on September the 10th, 1940, and Marcus Mosiah Garvey joined the ancestors on June 10th, 1940, and that will be 75 years ago, and we are getting ready to play some music dedicated to Walter Rodney of Guyana. Walter Rodney was assassinated on June 13th, 1980, and Walter Rodney, of course, wrote the great book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. He also was a founding member of the Working People's Alliance in Guyana. And Walter Rodney lived in the United States. He lived in Jamaica. He lived in Africa. And I had the honor of meeting Walter Rodney on many, many, many occasions. And he was one of the most down-to-earth people that you could ever meet. People never referred to him as very seldom would people refer to him as doctor. Most people, or his closest, the closest people to him, referred to him merely as Wally. And he was one of the most down to earth people that you could ever meet. And very bright and well traveled, well read, and genuine revolutionary scholar. So we're going to play Louis Lipke and Linton Kwesi Johnson, and then we're going to be speaking to Amdi. And stay tuned to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio.
Well, this is a tribute to the great Dr. Walter Rodney from my man Louis Lipke. Why right now I'm killing Earth, Mr. Badley. It a figure down in a history. Me come fi tell you about the great Walter Rodney. Hear me now. Me say them kill Walter Rodney. And right you know me said it hurt me so badly. And that they killing a figure down in a history. To make me tell you say them kill Walter Rodney. Cause hear me man. Say due to the fire in a Guyana. Me say a due to a fire in a Guyana. Me say them old Walter Rodney say my ringleader. He might be sent for barrister. And make me tell you, said them come from Jamaica. And Walter Rodney was a Amharic teacher. But right you know me, said them kill Walter Rodney. Lord, me God, me said it hurt me so badly. And that they killing a figure down in a history. Me said them kill Walter Rodney. Me said them never use a gun, them never use a SLR. Them never use a gun, them never use a SLR. Set a time bomb and them bomb up him car. Them kill Walter Rodney. And make me tell you how it hurt me so badly. Cause if a one black man come fi teach us the right, the whole of them make up and them out in life. Them kill Walter Rodney. To make me tell you, say them kill Walter Rodney. And right now me said it hurt me so badly. Cause due to the fire in a Guyana. Me say and due to the fire in a Guyana. Me say them old Walter Rodney say my ringleader. He might be sent for barrister. To make me tell you say them come from Jamaica. Say Walter Rodney was a Amharic teacher. To make me tell you say them kill Walter Rodney. Right and now me say the Turk me so badly. To make me tell you say them kill Walter Rodney. Me say them never use a gun, them never use a SLR. Them set a time bomb and them bomb a pimp car. And them kill Walter Rodney. To make me tell you say the dirt me so badly. Right you know me say me vex. Because them kill Malcolm X, me say me vex. Because them kill Malcolm X. Cause why you a have so much assassination? The people lock around and kill an innocent one. Say me vex. Cause them a kill Malcolm X, me say me vex. Tell you say them kill Malcolm X and then kill Walter Rodney. To make me tell you say the dirt me so badly.
You know, see how the cloud them just come sit up on me dream. Sit up on me dream like a dark silk screen. A dark silk screen over the vision I had seen. The vision I had seen. The vision I had seen. Some may say that Walter Rodney was a victim of hate. Some may say that him gone through heaven's gate. Some may say that Walter Rodney shouldn't take up his true weight and go carry it on him back like him did wear him on a rock. But look how the cloud I'm just come sat up on me dream. Sit up on me dream like a shout or a scream. A shout or a scream or a really ugly scene that awake me from the dream and alert me to the scheme. Some may say that Walter Rodney was a prisoner of fate. Some may say that him gone through the hero's gate. Some may say that Walter Rodney couldn't take his true weight. So him take it off him back and go put it on him lap and go fall in a trap and so burn him get it drop. But look how my dream come just get blown to smithereen. Blown to smithereen in the middle of the dream. The middle of the dream before the people them come in. The people them come in. The people them come in. Some may say that Walter Rodney was no shark for the sea. And all that him did want was to set him people free. With the workers and the peasants, him should have cooperate. But like a fish to the hook, him go bite from Burnham bait. You know see how my dream come just get blown to smithereen. Blown to smithereen in the middle of the dream. The middle of the dream before the really crucial scene. The really crucial scene when the people them come in.
Uhuru, you are listening to Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, the Toronto Great White North. And this Watson is on buttons today, and we heard music from Linton Kwesi Johnson and Louis Lipke, and the late Louis Lipke, and they were doing tributes to Walter Rodney. And joining me on the line from California is Amdi, a great poet, one of the original members of the Watts Prophets. And we are definitely, this is an interview that we are definitely, I've been anticipating for a couple of weeks. And I guess the first thing I want to do is welcome you to Uhuru Radio and Dynasport Music. Amdi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, and thank you all for inviting me.
Now, you have a brand new CD as a solo project. What is the name of that CD, and how did it come about?
Difficulties Technical is the name of the CD, and you get it on CD Baby. It came about by a guy named Craig Webb, who wanted to produce this album. He kept asking me. I really didn't want to do another album at 75. I mean, you know, who's doing albums at 75?
Yeah.
But anyway, pardon?
No, I said, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Jazz musicians albums at 75, yeah.
Yeah, Moms Mabley did too. And it was a success.
Okay.
But anyway, but Craig came along and he said that there were some musicians from Gil Scott's band that wanted to work with me. So I said, finally agreed to it, and he put it together. He brought all the musicians from Gil Scott's band together, several of them, not all of them, and flew down to Oakland, and we recorded several tunes. And I had already had a lot of work that I wanted to put out. I had some music by Don Cherry, and I had another young producer named Dave One, who's a current producer who's around now and works with all the latest rappers. I had wanted to do some of his stuff, and then I wanted to work with one of my old producers, Brian G. And then the group Blackalicious came along, wanted to be a part of it, and
right.
They did two cuts. So we came up with this difficulties technical.
Let me ask you before you continue, please let people know who Don Cherry was. He's a very important person in the history of African people.
That's right. Don Cherry was a great trumpet player who came out of Watts. And, well, they came out in the late 50s. Him, Arnett Coleman, Billy Higgins, Don Cherry. They came out with a thing. It was called, they were like avant-garde jazz. And that was kind of replaced with the new jazz. What was it? But they were kind of replaced. But Arnett Coleman and Don Cherry, as you were saying, they influenced music all over this earth. I think Arnett Coleman is probably known as one of the most influential jazz musicians alive.
Right.
And Don Cherry was right there as he was cutting it all in his early years in Watts, him and Billy Higgins. And also the other drummer from New Orleans, I can't think of his name, but Don Cherry
Ed Blackwell,
that's correct. And Don Cherry went around this earth over and over again. He played with he went to every culture that you could imagine, from China, India, Spain, all in Central and South America. And he is a great influence in jazz music. He had an album with Coltrane. He doesn't get the credit that
he
does really
do, right?
No, he doesn't.
I guess.
Not.
And the last thing I want people to know is his daughter is Nina Cherry, the artist
right.
out of. You're right. Yeah.
And also his son is Eagle Eye Cherry.
I didn't know
he
that.
He did a
no.
cut on, yeah, he did a cut on, I think it was Santana's greatest, one of his hits. One of his great albums, Eagle Eye was on that. Yeah, I can't think of the cut he did. And then he has another son named David Cherry, who plays around different places. He lives in Oregon. And a daughter named Jan Cherry, who plays violin.
Well, let me say that my favorite track on the album is a tune that you did called Swinging the Blues. I love that track. And, you know, blues is something that we, as African people, blues is, Bob Marley did a song, Talking Blues, and, blues is very popular among Europeans, and
But it seems as if our people, the young African people, are not necessarily in the blues. Or am I wrong in saying that?
Well, no. You know, when I come from the R&B era when it first started, rhythm and blues. That's what we called it. And like B.B. King was actually a rhythm and blues artist, but that kind of I guess keeping records of however they do it. He ended up being rock and roll, but a lot of the artists that rock and roll had in it came from R&B. And yes, blues was the foundation of everything that we did. I mean, like a lot of jazz musicians like to play blues, but they wanted to play it a certain way. And actually, what they were all, they were really playing the blues in another kind of way.
In the modern way, I guess, you know, in terms of doing in a different, with instruments that change, I guess, and technology change, and people kept up with the instruments and the technology, correct?
Well, I'm talking to Don Cherry and Horace Tapscott and them. They seem to think, a lot of them, that, you know, it kind of, our music will kind of, as it stop addressing our problems or it stop addressing our culture, we would leave it. In other words, the blues, we are no longer out in the fields chopping cotton like a lot of the old blues talk. And like Horace told us, like, his thing was that the new blues was rap music.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that's what they said. That's what Horace would say, and Don would. That's why they worked with us. When we first started, the only people who supported the rap music that the Watts Prophet was doing, artists, were jazz musicians. Don Cherry, Billy Higgins, Horace Tapscott.
Okay, I hate to cut you off again, but people don't know who Horace Tapscott was, and he was a great person who needs to be introduced to young African people and people, period. So who was Horace Tapscott?
He was a great producer and composer who lived in Los Angeles. He worked with everybody, with William Grant Steele. He worked with all the jazz musicians that came through Los Angeles. And I think he was working with Lionel Hampton when he decided, he was in that band, he decided that he didn't want to be on the road no more. He didn't want to do play that kind of music and constantly. He wanted to do new things, and he wanted to bring the music to the people. So he came back to South Central Los Angeles, to Watts, and he began to work, and he formed a thing called the Orchestra, the ARC. And you can pull all this up on the web. There's plenty of beautiful music on the web about Horace Tapscott. And he formed this orchestra, and he was like the Papa. We called him Papa. And he was the lead artist in Los Angeles of African-American artists, no matter what genre they were in. If you were into art, Papa was the leading artist, because he had come from the old tradition. And the old tradition in Los Angeles, the civil rights activists didn't all come from the church. The majority of them came from amongst the artists, the musicians, and the street people. That's what made the movement of the artists in South Central Los Angeles different than the Harlem Renaissance. And this was equal to the Harlem Renaissance, I would say. And the Harlem Renaissance came from the black intellectuals. What happened in western part of the United States, and in Los Angeles in particular, it came from the street people. So it came from the street up rather than down. And that's the difference. And, you know, it's kind of written out of history. The only people that talk, the only art movement that they talk about is the art movement started by Imamu Baraka. And Baraka and that crowd of artists. But that's not true. There was a movement, an art movement going in the western part of the United States, in Los Angeles in particular, from the late 30s. When the Pentecostal movement was started on Azusa Street. And Central Avenue had as much jazz and as many jazz musicians as New York. This is an untold story. and all of them was there. Billie Holiday. You must remember Los Angeles is the home, as I said, of Dexter Gordon. I mean, these were innovators, but no one ever really talks about that. And the music that was going on a place called Central Avenue and a place called Bronzeville, which was at the head of Central Avenue and went from Bronzeville to Watts, was nothing but music. And Horace Tapscott was a part of all of that. So when the 60s, after the riots, he began to gather the artists together. And I don't think it's a poet that from the Watts Writers Workshop or those different workshops that came up that didn't come through Horace's band, including myself. When that's the first big band I did poetry in front of. Horace.
Let me tell the listeners that John Huggins, former Black Panther, was killed. Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and Elaine Brown were part of Horace Tapscott's choir.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Yes. The artists were a part. The artists came, to, like artists like Don Cherry, Watts Prophets, Horace Tapscott. They didn't take sides. But they would help anybody that was trying to push the movement, that was pushing for right, that was pushing for African-American justice. And the artists played a big part, a very, very big part. Bud Schulberg, when he started the Watts Writers Workshop in Watts, which eventually...
I was on 103rd Street, right. I remember being there a lot. Well, Jane Cortez was a part of that, right?
That Jane Cortez had her own workshop, actually. She was with a great artist named Guy Miller and Jim Woods. They had Studio Watts, it was called. But Bud Schulberg started the famous Watts Writers Workshop, where Quincy Troupe, the guy who wrote Miles Davis. Yes, that's the workshop he came out of, Ojinki, and a whole school of writers. Quincy, K. Curtis Lau, the Watts Prophets, many writers. Yaphet Kotto had a drama class there. He taught drama. It was just a very wonderful place. It was destroyed by COINTELPRO. It was literally burned to the ground. And again, Horace was a part of all of that, and he was like our leader. He just died a few years ago. He was a leader of the African-American artists in Los Angeles.
Let me say that we only have about 15 minutes left, and I definitely, there's a lot of stuff we need to talk about. I probably going to have to bring you back because I know you have a lot to contribute, but you mentioned Ojinki. I went to school with Ojinki, but I wanted you to let the listeners know, what was your relationship to Robert Nestor Marley, Bob Marley, I know Jinky worked on magazine, and some of the first reggae articles came out in Soul magazine out of Los Angeles, California. I think it was Regina Jones was the publisher and editor of Soul magazine. But could you talk about your relationship to Bob Marley?
Well, Bob Marley and I were both members of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. I being an Ethiopian Orthodox priest and founder of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church in the western part of the United States. And it all started with a Rastafarian by the name of Kojo, who came across America and ended up in Los Angeles. We had never seen a Rastafarian. There hadn't been a Rastafarian that far west. And he introduced the Rastafaris, the Rastas, to us. And from there, I went to Jamaica and was introduced to them. And from there, I learned about the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And I became a member and began to work with Bob Marley. The bishop assigned us to work together in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church Youth Organization around the world. And Bob and I were working together on that. We had just got started. And he had recognized the value of rap, as they call it, but it was really poetry that we were doing. I was doing it. I happened to be in the studio one day, and I was just fooling around doing a poem to show you how bright Bob Marley was and how he recognized there was no rap music then. But as soon as he heard me doing, I didn't know he was in the studio, and I was just in there with some musicians. I was just started doing some poetry. In fact, the poem that I was doing was a poem I did at his funeral. And when I finished the poem, I heard someone clapping, and it was Bob. And he'd never heard me do poetry. And he said, I love that. He said, I want to record that. And then I told him about the Watts Prophets and gave him an album, et cetera. And then we were scheduled to record. He said, I want to put my music with those words. And I was gathering the rest of the Watts Prophets together to do that and still working with him in this organization. And then he came to me about a year before he died, because he came to our bishop, and he told the bishop that he was dying, and he wanted to be baptized into the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. His family had already been baptized, I think Rita and all the children, and that was really how it all began. And I had also worked with Bob when Jacob Killer Miller got killed. He had a wreck, and there was nobody. Yes, that's right. And I happened to be in Jamaica then, and none of the churches wanted to bury him. They were kind of against Rasta at that time. And Abuna Yisak of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church said, we will bury him. And so we were a part of that. Bob came and asked, and your bishop said yes. So we had a lot of little different experiences with Bob, and I happened to serve in his funeral. I have some very beautiful things that happened in that funeral. You know, we were, I remember, I'd never seen anything like this, but we were in the main auditorium. They had a big rally for him, and the whole country came to the big arena. And we had a service there. And as we were leaving, there were so many people that the Ethiopian church group were getting crushed. So the bishop rushed over by the military, and he brought us over there. And people, they kind of went around us then. But in doing all of this, the hearse left, the truck with Bob's coffin on it, left. And it was gone. And so we came, by the time we got outside, here we are standing and the coffin is gone, and we're supposed to be the car behind the coffin. And so we are standing there, and they're trying to get us there. And then someone comes over the radio to the police that were going to escort us and says that the truck had a flat. And ooh. That... and that we had plenty of time to catch up, and the police took us and we caught right up. But it was just a very mystical things happened. Jamaica is a very mystical place in the first place, but I had a lot of little mystical experiences with Bob. I'm trying to write all this one day.
And let me ask you this. What is the relationship to Louisiana to movement? Now, Garvey passed away on June 10th, 1940. I guess it would be 75 years. Same time you were born.
I was born in 1940, that's right.
Right, okay. So what's the relationship to Garveyism and to Louisiana and to Los Angeles? Because according to Tony Martin, his book Race First, Garvey's biggest movements or his most followers were in Louisiana. You know, I know my great grandfather was from Winnsboro, Louisiana. That's where he lived. He was from Mississippi, but he moved to Winnsboro. There was a division in Winnsboro, a Garvey division. So could you talk about Los Angeles and Louisiana in relationship to Garvey?
I wouldn't know a lot about that, but I know that the Deacons of Defense came out of, I think that's what they were called, the Deacons of Defense. They came out of Louisiana, and they were much before the Panthers and all of that. But they were always rebels in Louisiana. And so if there was any rebels, activity going on in this country, I'm quite sure that Louisiana was a part of it, because they were, that's where one of the biggest slave revolts, I believe, that in America was, one of them was in Louisiana. And
1812, I believe, yeah, 1812.
But Louisiana always, you know, in that migration, it, remember, it played a big part in the music. Jelly Roll Martin, you know, that's where he came from, Louisiana. There was a, like almost a straight line, a straight pipeline from Louisiana, Texas to Los Angeles. That seemed to be where those people, yes, because when I was a kid, most of the African Americans in Los Angeles were from Louisiana, Texas, and a few from Oklahoma and other those places, but the majority was from Texas and Louisiana. So I can see, you know, the influence of there, because like my father's name was Breedlove Smith. Now that was the kind of name you would find in Father Divine's movement.
Right, you know, right.
Yeah, and I often wondered, how did my father get this name? There's no record of how he got it. But, yes, I'd imagine that influence would be there.
Right. Now, the your CD, how can people get it? And I would like to thank my cousin, Ross Jimmy Hyman. He was the one that sent me this album. And I also
He's on there. Jimmy is on there. He's a great poet himself.
Right. But I gave a copy of this Omnipoet to Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, and there's a new radio station in St. Petersburg, Florida, and you're on the plane list. They have your CD down there, my friend, so look for some airplay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You know, some poems they just go by themselves. They just take on their own life, and that's sort of how this album has been doing. It's just taking on its own life.
You work with Larry McDonald. Larry used to be with Gil, right?
You said what? I couldn't understand.
He used to be with Gil. Larry McDonald was on your CD.
Larry McDonald's the musician?
Yeah, he's on your CD. Right, Larry McDonald.
Yes, he
right?
is. Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
Right. No, I saw him. He was with Gil, and he was with Gil for a long, long, long time. Larry McDonald is a percussionist, correct?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, there were several musicians that played with played with Gil that I worked. I can't remember all the names. I'm getting old now. I'm not as sharp as I used to be. But there were several of them on that CD.
Well, I wanted to recommend this CD to all everyone listening to this radio station. And how can people get it? And how can people get a hold of you?
They can get it off of CD Baby, and they can get me at World Wide Web. I'm the poet at suddenlink.net.
Okay, is there anything else you would like to add, my friend?
Well, just I hope that people enjoy the album. It was made to, basically, when I first made it, it was really for my family and my extended family. I have 40 grandchildren, and I wanted to leave them something. That's grand and great-grandchildren. And so that's what it was really all about. So it's just like talking to your family.
That sounds, yeah. That sounds good to me. So you leaving something concrete for the family and for the whole world, I guess.
That's right, if they wish to listen to it. But I started off really, it was addressed to my family. And I hope that, you know, it helps all families.
All right, sir. So it's very nice talking to you, and we would like to get you back maybe even next week. You think that's possible?
That's okay if you'd like me to come back and we can talk a little more.
Yeah, because I mean the whole history of Los Angeles, I grew up in
in Los Angeles, and we really would like you to talk about Jordan High School, Fremont High School, Jefferson High School, and Jacob A. Reese.
Yes, you're talking about
Jacob A. Reese is where the great Omdi and the great Barry White went to school.
That's right. That's right. And then you had Jordan and Jeff. I mean, if you look at the record books for sports in Los Angeles and California, period, you'll see Jeff, Jordan, but mostly Jeff. I mean, those were two very, very great schools. I never got the opportunity to go to either one of those, but I did go to Reese.
Let me say that I went to Fremont, and I got kicked out of Fremont, and I went to Washington, but I used to go to the city track meet, and the Scott twins, they used to have a race called the 180, and the Scott twins used to run the 180 and win it every single year. They would run 1-2 coming out that tunnel in East Los Angeles.
Yes, you remember the all-city meets.
Yeah, the all-city meets, and we would say, okay, who's going to come out of the tunnel? Is it going to be is it going to be Scotty or is it going to be Walter? And sure enough, every year they were C's at that time. You varsity B and C, I think. And the Whispers, the Scott twins were so small, they ran C. And every time they come out of that tunnel to East Los Angeles, we would say, okay, here comes Scotty or here comes Walter. And that would and then Hubie Watson, that's your boy from Jordan, right?
Yeah, that's
right. Hubie Watson was a great 100-meter man. And and Roy Ayers came out of Jefferson High School.
And then I remember Charlie Dumas, the day he jumped 7 feet. No one had ever jumped 7 feet out there in Compton.
Yeah,
that was the first time. Charlie Dumas, he was going, I think, Compton High, or was it Compton College? I'm not sure, because Compton College was Compton High at one time.
Right, you know, 64, Olympics, we had Ulysses Williams. I think Ulysses went to Centennial, and he ran the third leg of the mile relay. They took a gold medal, and then Richard Stebbins, who went to Fremont, he ran the third leg of the 440 relay and passed the baton on to Bob Hayes. But yeah, we had some notorious athletes in South Central, as they would say.
Yes, we did, man, and it was quite a community. We were poor, but we had community, not a hood. We had a community, and that came from Louisiana and Texas. It was sort of a tradition amongst us to work together, much better than we do today.
Yes, sir. So thank you very much, and I really appreciate it. I'm certain that the audience enjoys quite a bit from Brother Omdi. And
well,
take care of yourself.
Thank you very much. All right. God bless all of you.
All right. Take care. And we have been speaking to Omdi, and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio continues. We're getting ready to pay tribute to Clarksdale, Mississippi.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
And join the struggle to win the war of ideas and the struggle for African liberation. We are seeking volunteer activists to join our Uhuru Radio team as producers, hosts, and engineers. You can become an official distributor of the Burning Spear newspaper, the longest Black Power publication since the 1960s. Are you a copy editor or proof editor? We can use your expertise. Are you a video editor? We can see you as part of our progressive team. Volunteering means giving poor and oppressed people worldwide access to the voice of the international African working class. Call us at 727-824-5700. That's 727-824-5700 and get involved. you can donate meaningfully and become a sustaining paying member by logging on to uhurunews.com or again, call 727-824-5700. That's 727-824-5700. Get up, get into it, get involved.
Everybody, you!
Nanga Def is Wolof, and speaking to all the Wolof speakers in Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania, as well as the Wolof speakers all around the world. And Nanga Def is a greeting in Wolof, and I learned that from Youssou N'Dour. Youssou N'Dour is coming to Toronto, I think, in November, and I plan to be there with my red suit on. I wanted to see Youssou N'Dour, but we just finished talking to Amdi, a great poet out of Los Angeles, California, and we're getting ready to pay tribute to Clarksdale, Mississippi. This is the second time. This is part two of our tribute to Clarksdale, Mississippi, and we're going to be listening to O.B. Buchanan, Charles Wright and the Watts, 103rd Street Rhythm Band, Betty Swan, and many others. But right now we wanted to talk about Soul Heaven, and this is O.B. Buchanan. He was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Better hurry, soul heaven. Buy your tea, soul heaven. 'Cause it's going fast, yeah. Soul heaven. just that. There was a party.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist based in the not-so-great white north, and we are paying tribute to Clarksdale, Mississippi. Clarksdale, Mississippi is the hometown of, well, the birthplace of L.C. Cook, Sam Cook, Ike Turner. And Ike Turner, I understand they did a episode of Ike Turner on Unsung, which I plan to check out. Also, Charles Wright was from was born in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and Charles Wright is still very much in the land of the living. He's based in Los Angeles now. And we can get to listen to Charles Wright and the Watts 133 Rhythm Band. And after that, we're going to be listening to the name of Betty Swan, and Charles Wright plays on Betty Swan's song. But let's listen to a nice ballad by Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. This is called Love Land, and then we're going to hear Make Me Yours by Betty Swan.
To walk down that golden street, hand in hand with you, where all the lovers meet. Oh, I'd love to go to love land with you, pretty baby, 'cause my love is true. I swear I do. I have heard all about love land and all. Just can't enter, and happiness is the answer. Got to take me with you, baby. Got to take me with you. Oh yeah. How I'd love to walk down that golden street, hand in hand with you, where all the lovers meet. How I'd love baby, yeah.
got to take me by the hand. Tell me, baby, I'm your lover, man. Together we go where we'll stop.
Thank you. are through. But when you do, treat me as chill as you would a $1 million glass. Put me down easy.
Dire Spork Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Jalali, and we were listening to the music of Sam Cooke and Lou Rawls, Bring It On Home to Me. We also heard from L.C. Cooke. He did a song called Put Me Down Easy, and Sam Cooke, of course, and L.C. Cooke are brothers. And we also heard from Betty Swan and Charles Wright. Now, Charles Wright is playing on Betty Swan's Make Me Yours, Betty Swan, whose, I guess, birth name was Betty Jean Champion, was born, I see her bio says that she was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, but I always thought she was born in Arcadia, Louisiana, and I was born, and I met Betty Swan when I was I spent the summer of 1963 in Louisiana, and I met her. The next thing I knew, we were on the same label, Money Records, in Los Angeles, California. And Betty Swan, still in the land of the living, and she did a tour of England last year. And well, she performed in London last year. But this is June, and June is Black Music Month, and the Black Music Month was President Barack Hussein Obama dropped Black Music Month, and now he calls it African American Music Appreciation Month, and for whatever that's worth. But right now, we wanted to play some more music from Clarksville, Mississippi.
There's a young man by the name of Luther Lackey. He was born in Clarksdale, and he did a song called the New Orleans Blues. And this is a real blues song. Willie Dixon says that the blues are the facts of life, and the New Orleans, the situation in New Orleans is a fact of life. And Luther Lackey put it to music. This is the New Orleans Blues by Clarksdale, Mississippi's own Luther Lackey.
You know, everybody loves the blues, but I want you to know something. It's a different thing, but you have to live the blues. People wonder why when we sing, it sounds like we're in so much trouble and so much pain. But when you think about what happened in New Orleans on live TV, that was the blues. That's where the blues come from. That's the real blues. We're gonna sing about the New Orleans blues today. Wait a minute. They said a storm was coming. Then not like before. They say you better leave, Atlanta. But some just was too bold to go. Katrina brought destruction here of a terrible kind, and took some of my people back to 1829. I wonder why we still got the blues. Well, it make me cry now, long when I think about the New Orleans blues. Yeah, wait a minute. I just could not believe what I saw on the news. People crying for help and people hungry for food, and even the children had tears in their eyes. I wonder whatever happened to No Child Left Behind. I wonder why, no, no. No wonder why we still got the blues. Well, it make me cry, yeah, 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 when I think about the New Orleans blues. Hold on now. Some say black folk were looting and the white folk looking for food. Tell me, what would you do here now if you had to walk in these shoes? I thought this was America. It says the land of the free. But if you're black in New Orleans, they call you a refugee. No wonder why, no. No wonder why we still got the blues. Well, now it just make me cry, yeah, 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 when I think about the New Orleans blues. Well, I think I want to play it now. But I saw here now, people laying in the street had been dead for days, while the government wondered just what moves they gonna make. And family members, some of them still not found. It reminds me of what they said, y'all, when the slave was walking around. I wonder why, yes I do, why we still just got the damn blues. Yes, it made me cry when I think about the New Orleans blues. Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy. Oh, 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 oh.
Alafia, and you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and we were listening to the music of
Luther Lackey. Luther Lackey from Clarksdale, Mississippi. I think he's living in Jackson, Mississippi now, but he was singing about New Orleans, the New Orleans blues, and it was a rough blues song, it is true. And Chairman O'Malley Ishitella visited Russia, and he is going to be speaking at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, right after I'm off. You can hear Chairman O'Malley Ishitella talk about his visit to Russia. And we're getting ready to pay tribute to Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley was not from Jackson, Bo Diddley was not from Clarksdale, Mississippi. I think he was from Macon, Mississippi, but we wanted to pay tribute to Bo Diddley. And we're going to probably do a whole spot on Bo Diddley, half an hour on Bo Diddley next week. But Marvin Gaye called Bo Diddley the first star he ever knew. This is a quote from Marvin Gaye. Quote, "I love Bo. Meeting him was a very important moment in my life. He was a rhythmic genius like James Brown. He was a certified witch doctor," end of quote. So let's listen to the certified witch doctor, and this is Bo Diddley.
Told it in the fight, baby, diamond ring. If that diamond ring don't shine, he gonna take it to a private eye. Diddley called her Nanny Gold to make a pretty baby a Sunday cold. Oh, Diddley called her Bell Cat to make a pretty baby a Sunday hat. Come to my house with that cat bone, but take my baby away from home. Mother, that photo, where's he been? Up to your house and gone again. Bo Diddley, have you heard? My pretty baby said she wasn't bird.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Bo Diddley, the certified witch doctor, as Marvin Gaye called him. And joining us on the line from Ottawa, Ontario, is Audrey Redman. And Audrey Redman was born in southern Saskatchewan, and she attended St. Paul's Indian Residential School in Saskatchewan for 7 years, which was run by the French-speaking priests and the three nuns from Quebec. And in 1966, Audrey became part of what is known as the 60s Scoop. And after traveling the group home, the foster, of going from group home
the foster home circuit, she was relocated to a group home for emotionally disturbed children in Ontario. And she has lived in Ontario since the 60s and has three adult sons, two daughters, and six grandchildren from a mixed-race marriage. In 1999, on International Women's Day, Audrey hosted the first Honor the Earth program on CKLN 88.1. And Audrey Redman used to work with Wilson Blake, Brian Wright McLeod, and myself on CKLN. And with that, I would like to welcome Audrey Redman to Diasporic Music on Hulu Radio. And how have you been, Audrey?
Well, it's been quite a ride, like it usually is. I think as a First Nations in this country, it can't help but be quite a ride, you know, because we're still in that place where we are surviving. And, you know, it's very, very, very difficult situation to be in, especially when, you know, the words that are spoken are very conciliatory in the political world. But when you get down into, you know, the grassroots, it's a whole different story, because this is where really where the stories are made. You know, they're made with the people. And as a survivor, I know what I lived through, you know, as a survivor in those Indian residential schools. They were prisons for children. And through that whole process, we lost everyone. We lost our family. We lost our culture. We lost our language. You know, we lost our place. And we're still, as, you know, as First Nations and as the Indigenous people on this land, we're still wandering around here. And we're, you know, as has been written, you know, we're the inconvenient Indian. Well,
I'm sorry, before you get started, could you, before you really go into it, I think people need to know that the Canadian government admitted about cultural genocide on First Nations. Could you explain that to people?
Well,
what does that mean to you?
The cultural genocide part has just started to come out. It's something that I think that they've stayed away from because, you know, they've considered the other things, you know, in when they were, you know, considering the whole truth and reconciliation. It was designed as a mechanism for dealing with the issue of the Indian residential school, right? So it was a $2.5 billion settlement that was advertised and promoted as a healing strategy. So, you know, and it was advertised all over Canada, you know, through CBC, APTN. And what people don't realize is that those payments, that kind of money, it didn't come to us. So as a survivor, I know it because I've been living, and you know it, what kind of income that we've been living on. And you know, to me, when that is happening to the survivor, then I think the Canadian and the public need to ask, what happened here? You know, if this
where's the money going? Who's getting the money?
That's what we need to ask. And that's what no one asked. And to me, the whole truth and reconciliation was set up as part of it. And what people don't understand is what went into that settlement, what was required of the survivor. Well, that whole thing was set up in itself. In 2007, an official court notice came out to survivors, and it explained to us, you know, what we were supposed to do, and it said courts authorized it. So it was authorized already before we even had a chance to see it. So they might have chosen maybe one or two. It even says, you know, as few as two could decide what would happen there with the survivor. You know, we didn't hear anything about this. So I think what it did cause was it caused a lot of re-traumatizing of survivors. A lot of survivors died through the whole process because they had to go through what was called an ADR, alternative dispute resolution,
mm-hmm.
which in fact was a torture, because they had to then go back and we had to answer questions in detail of names, dates. You know, we were children.
So you had to relive, basically go through the whole experience again.
We had to relive the whole thing over again. And that's why I opted out. One of the reasons I opted out, and for me as a survivor who opted out, just the fact that it was coming through the government again, which they established the policy to put us in those places in the first place. Anybody who knows, if you've been victimized by an abuser, you don't go back to the abuser to get whatever it is that you need, unless it's going to be something that you decide as a survivor that you want to do. Well, we didn't get to decide that. The government decided that, and they decided how it was going to come down. So in the end, I think what happened was it all got dispersed into government departments, and I think that's what Canadians need to ask, is for accountability and transparency, because that's what they've been putting on First Nations people to do about the little bit of money that we get. So I think, the tables have to be turned here, and the fact is that, as First Nations people, we do need to be recognized that we are signatories of treaties on this land. And without us as signatories, as treaty people, this land, as Canada, as a nation, does not exist. And I think that's what Canadians need to realize, that without us, Canada does not exist. It only exists through the treaties. And it is the treaty people who were all put into those Indian residential schools, and how many of them died. And another thing that the public doesn't know, that for us to sign that settlement, we had to agree that all survivors who died before 2005, their children would not receive the compensation of their parents.
They would not. Would not.
They would not.
Okay.
So how many of the survivors of the women and the men who went missing, who were murdered, how many of them were survivors? Because in my family, we have one sister who was murdered in Vancouver's East Side. And that's why I wouldn't sign. Why should I sign that and have my sister forgotten? So those are very, very serious issues that most people don't know. Because this was
let me say that you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and this is Audrey Redmond, a First Nations sister who lived through what we are talking about. The newspapers in Canada, I don't know how much international, if this is being covered in the New York Times or the Guardian, but in Canada, this has been front page news, and it's also all over the TV, radio, so on and so forth. But Audrey Redmond was a victim of all of this. Let me say this before you continue. It needs to be stated over and over again that the Canadian government studied the South African, or the South African government studied First Nations people in Canada, and that's where they got part of the apartheid system from Canada.
They sure did. That's exactly where they got it. Because I can remember even on my own reserve, my uncle was a fisherman, and we couldn't sell anything off the reserve. We couldn't sell our fish. So, for the government to be telling the world how we're taking from the people, from the taxpayer, I think it's the other way around. We've lost more than, we've gained, as everybody knows. And I think they've set up the whole thing just so that it can be accessible. And what's happening now, really, it has to be looked at really at the basis of what this relationship is between Canada and First Nations. Because this is a serious issue that everyone is just overriding, because it has to do with the resources on the land. It has to do with the land claims. It has to do with where we stand as First Nations, because we're not welfare people here. This is our land. And,
no, I'm laughing because
you're not dealing with welfare people, like you said. This is the land belongs to the First Nations.
Well, we don't even believe that it belongs to us. We don't believe anybody. It belongs to anyone. This land,
Native people have a special position of the land, right?
We were originally on this land. Sustains us, right? And I think that's where the difference lies between what First Nations, what our values are, because our values are based on respect of the land, respect of one another. And that initially, that's I think where we went wrong, is that we thought that the people who came here and started all of this with the governments and taking the land, they talked a respectful language. But that's not their actions, and that has remained as part of the basis, part of the root of this country and also of the United States of America. So I think we need to go back to the root of what we're living now. We're living another culture, and we're trying to, you know, recognize that, no, we do have a different root than what's been planted here. This is not what indigenous people have always lived all over the world. This now here is a controlling entity that controls because it's fearful of what it's going to lose. First Nations people have never been fearful of what we're going to lose. You know, we're concerned about what's here, you know, and respect what's here because this is life, and that's why people came here. So I think, you know, our values really have to be respected. And once we're there, I think then we can start talking about equality. But right now, what has happened with all this truth and reconciliation, really people have to talk about, you know, think about what truth is and not believe everything that they say as truth, because we know that that's not true. You know that, I know that, you know, and if people were really to think about it, they would know it too.
Let me ask you this. What has the three parties in Canada, how have they responded? How has the Conservative government, how has the opposition, the NDP and the Liberal Party, have they taken any different positions? Or Stephen Harper, when he was there, when the announcement was made, he basically just stood there and couldn't say anything, basically. I guess he was embarrassed. When they talked about the culture of genocide, how have the three parties responded to the situation?
Well, it's not surprising that Harper would remain mum, because that's the way it's done. If you just remain quiet and deny, people will soon forget about it, and that's the way it's been done here. So as far as the Liberal Party, Chrétien, in 1996, was the prime minister. At that time, Ovid Mercredi was the national chief of the Assembly of First Nations in Canada. He was finishing up his second term, I think it was, or third term as national chief. He was on his way out. The Royal Commission was just coming out. The Assembly of First Nations asked to see that Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. Chrétien wouldn't allow it. This was the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. That Royal Commission, I just read in this reporter from the Ottawa Citizen, his name is Kennedy, he just wrote something that it's very surprising, like how something could be said like that. But it said, this is what he said. The fact that the government of Canada and a few First Nations representatives devised the plan, because as Mark Kennedy's article in the Ottawa Citizen stated in 1997, the Chrétien government was frightened of admitting liability in case victims sue and was veering away from doing what the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples urged it to do, issue an unqualified apology. Instead, federal lawyers are drafting a statement of reconciliation designed to acknowledge what went wrong without actually admitting negligence. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples called for an apology and measures to heal the victims. It said, By focusing on the savage who is in need of psychological salvation, governments have deliberately chosen to focus on the now of the problem. That was taken in written in 1997, Residential School Victims to Receive Federal Funding, by Mark Kennedy, written in the Ottawa Citizen.
Wait, he used the term savages?
Yes. By focusing on the savage who is in need of psychological salvation. This was in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in 1996, and Chrétien would not let Ovid Mercredi or the Assembly see that Royal Commission. And he even went to England to see the Queen, but the Queen wouldn't see him.
So the Queen would not see him.
Yeah, would not see Ovid Mercredi or the AFN, the delegation that went there to speak on this. Because they didn't see this, but this was in there. Kennedy was able to write about this. So even by saying that in 1997 inside of that Royal Commission, you can see there the racism that's through there.
And how has the NDP responded? Now, the NDP, you know, people in the United States and other parts of the world, a lot of people in the U.S., you know, Canada's a great country because unlike the Americans and the British, you know, Canada has three parties and the NDP has been in power, not nationally, but the NDP, you know, it's a lot of credit. And I don't think they should get a lot of credit, but how has the NDP responded to this question?
Well, I think, like you said, it's a weaving of three parties. Just like, you know, this nation here is considered, you know, French and English, supposedly First Nations, you know, but that's what it says in policy. But it really doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in truth. And I think the NDP are closer, you know, socially minded, but I think they're still, in the end, I think what it comes down to is taxpayers. And you know, most Canadians, I think that's really what they're concerned about is they're concerned about their property, and they're concerned about their jobs, and they're concerned about their own families. And that's pretty well how it's been, you know, for a long, long time. And as First Nations, I think, you know, we have always been community-minded people. And that's something that we've lost in our own land, you know. And that's, I think, to me, one of the saddest things is that we've lost so much in terms of how we can live our own values. I just took part in a blockade last summer in Gatineau, just over the bridge, because they were going to, well, they did. They took artifacts that were 3,500 to 6,000 years old, over 25,000 artifacts. They were going to take to a landfill, which they probably did. So they have no respect whatsoever for what is anything that is of value to First Nations people of any significance. So to us, that's where we stand. I mean, you know, it's all written nice and pretty, like truth and reconciliation. But when it really comes down to the truth, how we live is really, you know, tells me so much more. I live in a city that's the capital city of Canada, and I live in
Ottawa.
In Ottawa. I lived in Toronto for 17 years in a multicultural city where there was some racism, you know, but Ottawa, Ottawa, it is so evident. It is so clear. You can't believe what I've gone through since I've been in here for 2.5 years, the things that I've been called since I've been here. They don't like the sight of a Native person or an Inuk person. You know, we're just so clear that we're here, that we're still here. And it, you know, and many people don't like it. And it's so clear that they don't like it.
Now, we're running out of time, and I wanted you to cover the fact that, you know, there was a video produced on a short story. You did a short story called A Little Brown Girl, and there was a short video based on some of your poems. Could you talk about that?
I wrote that back in 1999, just when I was starting to deal with the whole residential school and what had happened. And like I think many residential school survivors, we had put that so far behind us that it was like a dream that it happened to somebody else. When I had to start looking at all of the papers that they had sent me, it took me there. And the only way that I could deal with it was through writing and through the poetry. And that's since then, that's how I've had to deal with it, because, you know, not as an opt-out. I've written letters upon letters. You want to talk about different parties in Canada? I've written to them all.
All three.
And about all the issues, about why are survivors still living in poverty when you've got all this money? You know, why are you leaving us way out of everything? You know, and we're left here forgotten again. And you're out there speaking for us. So all that we said as people who opted out is not being heard. I called CBC, Anna Marie Tremonti. She wouldn't answer my call. APTN was going to do a story. They reneged because they get funding. So everybody who's getting funding, they will not open their mouth, their mum.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
All right, we're running out of time. Could you talk about the Honor the Earth program you did on CKLN FM, and now we have had a station called CHRY, and they're getting ready to be cut, and they're going to go commercial. We have a few minutes left. Could you talk about your experience at CKLN 88.1?
Well, I think that's probably one of the best experiences I think I've ever had in my working life. And as you know, as community radio people, we didn't get any money for it. But for me, it was the best way to get to know community. And I would do it all over again, just because I had such a great time with CKLN. I had such a great time getting to know everybody, and I understand why CRTC, you know, looked at us the way they did, because we were a very, very powerful station that was already speaking the truth about what people are speaking about now. You know, we were before our time. You know, we were the ones who were that, you know, we were breaking the way, trailblazers. You know, I think CKLN probably was always a trailblazer. And I really, really miss it. And I'm sure the listeners miss it.
yeah, I know Milton Blake and you and Brian Wright McLeod. Brian Wright McLeod was First Nation brother.
Yeah.
Milton Blake was my partner in crime. He was my...
Yeah, I often think of Milton. And I speak of him many times to people that I get a chance to speak to. He was quite an inspirational and really very dignified man, I'd say.
Well, I would never forget the fact that Milton came on at 4 to 6, and I came on from 6 to 6:30, then you came on from 6:30 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
And every week we would meet after.
Yeah.
After those three shows and talk about our children, and
mm-hmm.
he would talk about Jamaica. I would talk about the U.S. and Ontario, and you would tell us about the First Nation experience. And that was a book we had. We had some very deep conversations.
Well, I always say that you and Milton were my mentors. So I picked up on how you handled and how you hosted your shows, and I followed in your footsteps. so I it means a lot to me too. I really think of you and Milton a lot, and of the people there. I think we did a lot there in that city. And I know in the short time I was there, I really felt we did a lot.
25 years ago, they cut. We had a United Front, and we had an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist United Front, and we had men, women, we had African people, we had Euros, we had French Haitians, we had straight gay. We had similar politics. We had fights and all that, but we had a united front, and I think they had to break that up.
Yeah, they sure did. They know how to do that very well, and it's too bad that we don't know how to recognize it soon enough.
I think we have finished. We have run out of time. Is there anything else? Could you sum up what you wanted to say in 1 minute? I hate to put that on you, but we have to get out of here. As they say in Canada, we have to get the puck out of here.
Yeah, right. Well, I just want to say that, we have to keep aware, and I think we have to really keep our spirits strong. And really, we're going to have to sometimes dig for the truth, because there's a lot there that covers it. And I think as writers, as journalists, as people out there who want to make a difference, we're going to have to stay strong, because sometimes it's very, very difficult. And I think we're going to have to work on being united, because it's the only way.
All right. Thank you very much. I have been speaking with the moderator. I would like to thank Lisa Watson for her technical brilliance today. We will see you in the whirlwind. We're going to play our theme song, The Spiritual, by John William Coltrane and Eric Allen Dolphy Jr., another man from Los Angeles, California, but we will see you in the whirlwind.